Howdy, everybody, and welcome to another BP Movie Journal, the show I do where I talk about the stuff I've seen since the last time I did one of these. I'm David. It's just me. And not that you probably care, but this one's coming out on a not normal day of the week. But I kind of realized I should have done one the same week that Scott and I did the public transit movies, because I was looking at the calendar and realizing I'm not going to be able to, probably not going to be able to do another movie journal till after TIFF. So I've got a bunch of movies I haven't talked about that I need to tell you guys about, obviously. I've been dying to get this off my chest. I am going to start with the American Cinematheque here in Los Angeles did showed a bunch of Jean Eustache movies, of which I had never seen any, and the only one I ever really even knew about was The Mother and the Whore, which I did not make it to see, but I did make sure to see My Little Loves, which is a 1974 coming of age story about a boy. But if whatever you're imagining, oh, French 70s coming of age story, that'll be cute. It's not. The movie is, I would say the kid is a little creep, but I think the movie is basically just largely being honest about the degree to which little boys are creeps, especially at the age they start getting erections and start competing with other boys for not just the attention of girls, but the sort of unlocking achievements with girls. How far have you gotten? That sort of thing. So it is, but the kid is like weirdly charming, even as you're like, oh my god, what a monster! I wouldn't let my kid within 100 yards of this kid. It's very episodic. It's not always pleasant to watch, but it's fascinating and honest and really, really compelling stuff. So next up, I've got went to a double feature of movies written by Abraham Polonsky, both of which I had not seen before. No relation to Roman. This is Polonsky, and he was a blacklisted writer. he wrote a movie for Robert Wise under, I think, someone else initially took credit, but the DCP that they screened had restored his credit, of a movie called Odds Against Tomorrow, directed by Robert Wise, starring, it's got a great cast. It's Harry Belafonte and Robert Ryan are kind of the twin leads, and then Ed Begley is, I don't know, the guy who gets them together, and then Shelley Winters is there, and Gloria Graham shows up, and the once and future Trapper John M.D. Wayne Rogers shows up as an uncredited character who gets beat up in a bar. Basically, the movie is about Harry Belafonte plays a gambler who is running out of luck, and Robert Ryan plays a convict who's just been released from prison, and Ed Begley plays an ex-cop who knows about a score, a bank they can rip off in this like small town. And he recruits the two of them separately, and it's not until they get together that Robert Ryan realizes that his partner is a black man, and Robert Ryan's character is very racist. So you've got, it's got that, but it's also you spend a lot of time with Robert Ryan just being a monster in general. He's the one who beats up Wayne Rogers. But also the actual like scenes of the crime being done and the way that it goes wrong is so sharp and so lively, and it has, you know, Robert Wise is no slouch. It has the elegant direction and editing that you expect from later masters of like thriller suspense movies and crime movies like Steven Soderbergh and stuff like that. It's a it ends in this really amazing sequence with the starting with the heist. Everything's going right, then things start going wrong. Largely, I mean, it's not, the movie is not subtle about the fact that things go wrong largely because Robert Ryan is too racist to trust Harry Belafonte to do his end of the job. So it is kind of his fault, but things go wrong, and then the movie keeps heightening up to this pretty crazy, literally explosive finale. And the movie's just a real discovery for me. I'd heard of it, and I definitely, when Belafonte died, I had it had been on my list of things to check out that I didn't get to. But man, it's a new fave. And then second up, they showed Force of Evil, which Abraham Polonsky not only wrote but also directed, and it stars John Garfield as a, I guess a, I don't think he would consider, the character would consider himself a corrupt lawyer. He is a lawyer whose client is a major organized crime head. And he's trying to help or basically organize his client's businesses and eliminate competition. The competition includes his own brother. So the sort of engine of the movie, the juice here, is that John Garfield wants to get his brother to fall in line under his boss, saying, "Hey, you'll get rich. Just join us. Don't go against us, because things won't go good for you." And his brother, who, despite running like a numbers racket and being a bookie, like, considers himself an honest businessman, which the movie is aware of the tension there, but he doesn't want to get involved. And it's, I mean, Abraham Polonsky's he's an incredible writer. John Garfield is one of the best of the time. I would say the direction is not, I mean, having just, this is a double feature of these, having just seen Odds Against Tomorrow, it definitely feels a little bit more just obvious, and kind of like there's maybe a little bit too much room in the shots, and it's centering the dialogue and just two people talking, and it doesn't have that the grace and the forward visual momentum that Robert Wise brought to Odds Against Tomorrow, but still very good. Yeah, I'm glad I went. The Skirball Center was doing a whole series on the Blacklist, and they'd done it a bunch of double features, and that was the only one I was able to make it to. All right, next up. Speaking of non-directors stepping behind the camera to direct, Riley Keough, along with Gina Gamel, or Gamel, I'm not sure how you say her name, has made her directorial debut with a movie called War Pony that is beautiful and stunning and heartbreaking and funny, and I love this movie so much. It's called War Pony. It's two different, it's another boys coming of age movie, except it's two different boys who live essentially across the street from each other on a reservation. They're both Lakota. So the movie is like My Little Love, very episodic. It's just sort of following these two. So the one is like a 12-year-old, and the other one is older. He's, you know, post high school age. So I don't know. He's supposed to be in his 20s, early 20s probably. And it just follows their different stories. You know, the younger one gets kicked out of the house. The older one is enterprising and good at making money in ways that are on the fringes of legality. Just kind of this, the black market barter trade type of system. And apparently Riley Keough and Gina Gamel spent a lot of time with Lakota friends of theirs, and developed this script based on those friendships and those experiences. And you can tell that this is, you know, from the 30,000 foot view, this is an issue movie about the struggles of growing up on a reservation. But up close, it's a character movie. It's a personal, human, intimate movie about people, which is why, yeah, some terrible things happen in these kids' lives. But also, they're like kids who have fun and laugh, and the movie is often very energetic and funny. And there are parts where you can, especially the older kid whose name is Bill. You really like root for him a lot of the time, and so it's not one of those issue movies, like liberal issue movies that's meant for like liberal viewers who don't relate. It's meant to make them like feel good. It's not that at all. It's just a really, really beautifully made movie. Okay, next up, cool movie alert. Yeah, it's another Nicolas Cage sort of direct to streaming type of deal, or direct to VOD type of deal, directed by a guy named Yuval Adler. The movie is called Sympathy for the Devil, and it's largely a two-hander where Joel Kinnaman plays a sort of everyman who we meet when he's on the way to the hospital where his wife is giving birth, and he's frantic, he's trying to get there in time, and as he's looking for a place to park in the parking garage, Nicolas Cage in a crazy outfit and dyed red hair gets into his backseat, points a gun at him and says, keep driving. The premise of the movie is it goes on like borrows definitely from A History of Violence, where we come to realize that like, oh, Nicolas Cage thinks Joel Kinnaman is someone else, or is Nicolas Cage right and Joel Kinnaman is this other guy? That's the tension, but really what this movie is about is you write a bunch of fun dialogue and you give it to Nicolas Cage, just stuff that he can chew on for 90 minutes, and you shoot it in a way that is cool and interesting, and you're gonna have a fun time. So yeah, Sympathy for the Devil, definitely recommend. Cool, like you know, movie VOD rental. Next, I wish I could say the same about this VOD movie called Susie Searches, directed by Sophie Cargman. It has a great cast. It's Kiersey Clemons, Alex Wolff, Jim Gaffigan, Ken Marino, Rachel Sennett shows up, Jeffrey Owens is in it. Dolly Wells, if you like her, Jared Gilman, from Moonrise Kingdom, Ann Patterson. Kiersey Clemons plays a teenage girl who is like an internet sleuth and has like a YouTube show about her trying to like solve unsolved crimes, but she's just not getting the traction that she wants until she manages to save a fellow student at her college. Oh yeah, it's high college, not high school. She's in college. She manages to save a fellow student who is kidnapped and who already has a huge social media presence. So suddenly she's like, she did this thing, and Alex Wolff plays the guy, but she's kind of riding his coattails to the fame that she wants. Unfortunately, the movie is just way too obvious. There's a twist that you honestly, based on my plot description, might have already guessed. I guessed it pretty quickly. And I'm not even a guy. I get fooled by the most obvious twists. But and Kiersey Clemons, whom I've liked in the past, is just like cartoonishly over the top as this awkward but eager nerd girl. Alex Wolff is good as usual. Kevin Marino's really good. But, yeah, I can't really recommend it. I can recommend Barbie, but by now you've either seen it or decided you're not going to see it, I would guess. But, yeah, I really liked Barbie. And I was one of the skeptics. I was one of the ones who was like, oh, it's another IP movie. They're going to shackle Greta Gerwig. And I'm not interested in getting into like whether or not she is biting the hand that feeds her. I don't think she is. I think this serves Mattel very well. I guess I did get into it, didn't I? But I think this serves Mattel very well. But the first thing is that the movie is hilarious. Like, I feel like maybe people, or maybe it's just me who keeps forgetting how funny Greta Gerwig is, because, like, you know, I mean, Lady Bird's definitely funny, but it's not a comedy. Same with Little Women, has funny stuff, not really a comedy. But stuff like, I mean, she wrote or co-wrote, I can't remember, Mistress America, which I think is one of the best comedies of the 2010s. Barbie is, that's the first thing you need to know. The headline of the story here is that this movie is fucking hilarious. I laughed so much during the movie. Beyond that, I liked the boldness of the movie's, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, didacticism, maybe? But I liked how front and center it is. But I think if you're watching this movie and you have the misfortune of being a stupid person, you might see it as being preachy about feminism. But I think you'd be missing all of the other things that are going on, not even under the surface, just not blared at you the way the movie, like, literally, it has an entire sequence that is just America Ferrera making, like, feminist arguments, and it becomes, but, like, that sounds bad, but it's a part of the plot, and it actually is funny that, it's funny to me that they used, they shoehorned it in that way. What I think maybe some of the backlash is to is that, like, okay, there's a great episode of the show Corporate, maybe my favorite episode of the show Corporate. If you haven't watched it, I think it's on Paramount Plus. It only lasted like two seasons, but it's a really funny show. But the corporation, some of the characters come up. They design a line of makeup for men, and they're like, this is an untapped market. They spend the whole movie like market testing it and developing it, and like the whole episode that's what they work on. At the very end, they're going to pitch it to the head of the company, Lance Reddick, and they start by saying, something about we can prey on men's insecurities, or, you know, we can profit off their insecurities. And Lance Reddick just says, oh no, men aren't insecure, and just shuts it all down. And I feel like some of the backlash against this movie has been from men like that, because the Greta Gerwig in the movie has a great deal of empathy for the Kens in Barbie Land. But I do wonder if those guys are like, I don't need that pity or whatever. I'm doing fine, you know? Toxic masculinity does not take a toll on me. The patriarchy is not unfair across the board. It works fine. That's the kind of thing I think they're thinking. But again, at the end of the day, the movie is very, very funny. And that's reason enough to see it.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Bite clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So that's Barbie. That's me talking about Barbie. Next up, I saw a Japanese an anime film called The First Slam Dunk, directed by Takahiko Inoue, and it's a sports anime. It's a basketball, as you might have guessed, anime movie basically there's a high school boys basketball team, and they're in some sort of championship game or something. It's not really important, but it's important that they want to win, and we want them to win because they're our guys. And the entire movie, it's sort of the framing device, though it's a huge part of the movie, is the game. But then throughout the game, we keep getting flashbacks. There's one character in particular who's clearly the lead character, but we keep getting flashbacks of the other players on the team and how they, like, their sort of journey to where they are now, that it's all come up to this moment, it's all culminated in this potential for this team that's never won anything or never beaten this other team to, like, beat them for the first time. I mean, story and character wise, I think the movie is, like, fine and competent, but it's really a movie made up of these fantastically tense moments and these crescendos, and it is impressive that the movie is over 2 hours long, which is long for animation, and it keeps riding this wave of every moment being so big and being so crucial, and you want to, like, stand up and cheer or clap at every single basket or every single blocked shot, which it, like, always, like, goes into slow motion, or you don't realize until the last second that the guy is going to make it, or the guy's just out of frame and his hand comes in and blocks the shot, and it's slow motion, and then it comes back into, you know, the sound goes out and then it comes back in, and it's just like, it's all very exciting. It's the kind of movie that I think could be, I feel like I'm stealing this from someone else who's on the show. So I think Julie might have said something along the lines about movies that are, like, described as being a trailer for itself. It's a trailer for itself. And you could take that as a criticism, but I think it's really awesome and really impressive that Takahiko Inoue sustains this height for so long. This hang time, what I should have said. That would have been more clever. I rewatched Rosemary's Baby for the first time in a long time, and it's even better than I remember. I think the first time I saw it, I loved it then too, but the first time I saw it, I spent so much time just focusing on poor Rosemary. This is, like, just, she's a victim, which she obviously is. She is victimized deeply in the movie, but that was kind of my only take, so that by the end, when she makes the decision that she makes, I felt sorry for her. But this time, I felt something different. Not happy for her. She still went through hell and was raped by a demon and all of these things. There is something about her stepping up at the end. Maybe you could see it as giving in, but her stepping up, I don't know. I found it more psychologically and emotionally complex than I had in the past. And also just a terrific time. It's a strangely fun watch. There's all sorts of little moments. Natalie did not watch it with me. When she saw that I was watching it, when she came home and I was watching it, she said, did you get to the part where she went to Fidel Sassoon? Because that's my wife's favorite line in the movie is not, you know, what have you done to its eyes or anything like that. It or all of them witches. No, it's I've been to Vidal Sassoon when she comes home with the pixie cut or whatever. I love that. I love that about my wife, and I love that line. So fantastic movie, even better than I remembered. Home stretch here. Just last week I watched a movie called The Pod Generation by Sophie Bart. Great, another movie with a great cast that just doesn't really land it. It's Emilia Clarke and Chiwetel Ejiofor are a couple, and I feel like there's other people who show up that I recognize, but now I'm not seeing anything. But there are a couple in a future, an AI dictated future, where Emilia Clarke's character actually works for a company that makes like these AI personal assistants, like Alexa, but like times a million. And she wants to have a baby, and if you can afford it in this world, you can have a baby grown in a little pod that you carry around, but you can also like store and charge or whatever, and you don't have to like be pregnant 100% of the time, even though it's your baby and you're taking care of it. And so they do that, but Chiwetel Ejiofor's character is a sort of I don't know, he romanticizes the 20th century, I guess. This takes place, I think, it doesn't give an exact year, but it's clear that it's late 21st century, I think, or early 22nd. I just, you know, good cast, definitely like really well thought out production design, and, you know, handsome, competent cinematography, although it has that like sort of, I've described it in written reviews before as like every surface looks like brushed nickel, if that makes sense, that sort of like soft texturedness to the walls and everything. It just looks, it looks like an Apple TV original, and it's way too blatant. Not in like, I feel like I'm contradicting myself, because I said I liked that Barbie was so upfront with its arguments, or the arguments that it was at least interested in dissecting. Whereas this movie, I think, thinks that it's smarter than it is by slipping these things in. This will mean nothing to 95% of the audience, but if anyone remembers Brett Gelman's bit that he used to do called iBrain, I think, it reminded me of the first, not the later part of iBrain, if you know it. If not, look up Brett Gelman iBrain, it's hilarious, but make sure there are no children around. But the first part of iBrain, where it's like a sci-fi, it's clearly a point of view of a sci-fi author who thinks he's being really profound, but is actually being quite trite. That's what I thought of when I watched The Pod Generation. What are we up to next? Oh, a really charming movie, recently restored, directed by Fran Rubel-Kazooie, whose only other feature directorial credit is the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie with Christy Swanson from 92, I think. This movie is called Tokyo Pop, and it stars Carrie Hamilton, who is actually, was, unfortunately, she passed away of cancer at a young age, but was was the daughter of Carol Burnett. And Carol Burnett, I think, has co-financed this restoration. Basically, Carrie Hamilton plays a New York rock and roll singer who's gotten dicked over by the guy she's in a band with that she's dating, and so sort of on a whim, to get revenge at him and also for a change of scenery, she steals their rent money for the month and moves to Japan. She ends up finding a career as a singer there. There's a little love story. And the movie is like, it has all these like punk new wave edges to it, and like the outfits and the kind of no frills direction of it, which is not a an insult that I like the way the movie's directed. But at its heart, it is a very sweet romance that also loves love songs. And that, you know, they're, she might be in like a punk band at the beginning, but like the songs she sings the most are like, Do You Believe in Magic and You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman and stuff like that. And Kara Hamilton had a beautiful voice. Yeah, if you get a chance, I'm sure the restoration, I know it's playing like, I don't know, Film Forum or something, but I'm sure the restoration means a new Blu-ray on the horizon. So don't sleep on it. Check it out. Tokyo Pop. Good stuff. You want some great stuff, though. I saw the new Iris Axe film, Passages, which is about Franz Rogowski, I guess, is the main character. And at the beginning of the movie, he is married to a character played by Ben Whishaw. And but then he ends up having an affair with a woman named or played by Adele Exarchopoulos. And it's one of the best performances that I can think of in years, Franz Rogowski's character. How aware the movie is, and even somewhat aware he is, of how toxic and selfish he is, but he cannot not be loved for even a second. So he breaks people's hearts, but just expects them to forgive him. And he's so charming that it works a lot of the time. And Franz Rogowski just gets this woundedness, but also the selfishness. It even works on you, the audience. I mean, at least it worked on me, that I like, this fucking guy is like fucking over people left and right, and yet I'm like, don't hurt him. You know, I feel so bad for him. So I mean, that would be, I mean, Franz Rogowski's performance would be enough to recommend the movie alone, but as I think on a recent episode, I can't remember what it was, a recent episode, Scott and I talked about how, as a director, Iris Axe, who was no slouch 10 years ago, continues to get better and better in terms of simple things, simple but beautiful framing and mise-en-scene. And the film ends with a sequence that I won't describe it because it's the end of the movie and that would be mean, but it's a sequence that you've seen before, but there's something, the marriage of the way that Iris Axe has chosen to shoot and light it and where he's chosen to set this sequence and the nonverbal acting on Franz Rogowski's part at the end elevates the movie to the level of probably best of the year so far, I have to say. Fantastic movie, Passages. Finally, another rewatch. I rewatched Agnes Varda's One Sings, the Other Doesn't, which I had already liked to begin with, and this is sort of like Rosemary's Baby, liked to begin with, and then loved on a more recent viewing. Mostly because I became fascinated with the passage of time, because the movie starts in 1962 and ends in 1976, and it's over 2 hours long, and yet it glides so smoothly. The characters glide, the two characters, one of them sings, the other doesn't. They glide apart, they glide back together. There's something that is connecting them, but no scene feels like it's full little playlet or anything. Everything just goes into one another, even when a decade passes in between shots. It's beautifully constructed. on Anya Svarda's part. And I'll say that I watched it in preparation for discussing the movie on, and I was a guest on an episode of the Red Rose Film Podcast, which is a podcast that talks about films through a lens of, you know, left-wing political theory. So probably not for everyone, that podcast, but I learned a lot because I'm, you know, I'm a lefty, but I'm not like immersed in theory about, you know, Marxist feminist and feminism and the stuff that we talked about with Hal and Craig over at Red Rose Film Club. But yeah, check out Red Rose Film Club. Check out my episode. Check out the other episodes.